Sometimes I wish people could hear what Brett says as we get ready to start the show. But I'm Johnny Arola, this is the Daniel Report, and that's Brett, the guy who was talking very recently.
I just said, John, have a good show. And I also told him that there's a new happy half hour this evening. It's 7 p.m. for members streaming
live.
King of Phillips, host of Lost in the Wild on the Travel Channel joins us, an old colleague of mine.
Is it a wilderness themed episode?
No, we just drink scotch out of vessels provided by our new sponsor, Bespoke Post.
Ooh.
Go to bespokepost.com and use the code TURKS20 to get 20% off deliveries of cool stuff for people who give a damn. Today we feature a decanter made of environmentally responsibly sourced glass. And it's fantastic.
Okay.
TURKS20 at bespokepost.com.
I look forward to it. And what you can look forward to over the course of the next hour is an awesome show. We're gonna dive into Mike Pompeo. He's been talking a lot over the past day and not a lot of it makes sense. And it's very consequential. So we're gonna be analyzing that. But also, Boeing, which has had a bad couple of years, also about to have a bad day because they released more communications, internal communications of their employees about the plane that obviously had two crashes. Many people lost their lives. The communications are just amazing. What some of these pilots and software engineers and test pilots and all that were saying to each other about what they thought was going to happen. And so we've got that for you. And then we're gonna close out the show with a really interesting story. Last week, a former Fox presenter came out with a story about how Donald Trump had tried to proposition her. And she apparently, in true bombshell fashion, has received a bit of at least temporary strike back for coming out with that story. So we're gonna be analyzing that to close out the show. But we got a lot to get to before that, so let's jump right into it.
Well, I got lots of different feedback from the briefing. I was there, I was one of the briefers. I thought we did a dynamite job.
No one is more pleased with themselves these days than Mike Pompeo, and with as little cause as possible. So Mike Pompeo, his job is to try to make sense of what has come out from the Trump administration about the intelligence that led up to the strike against Qasem Soleimani. So it appears, based on everything we've seen that's been leaked from people who've talked with Trump, who were involved in the process, that this was a result of Trump's impetuousness. He got emotional and decided to do something that the Pentagon didn't expect him to do. Wall Street Journal reported last night that he also apparently was under pressure from some senators who will be involved in the Senate impeachment trial that wanted him to do something about Soleimani. So that was apparently on his mind too, which is just great. But you can't come out and say that. You have to pretend that you had some sort of cause that had to do with stopping an impending attack. And so he's been on the news a lot. We're gonna go through some of his recent appearances. Before we get into it, Brett, we haven't talked about this topic in a bit.
Well, in terms of the pressure that he was feeling from senators involved in the impeachment hearing to do the impeachment trial to do something about Soleimani, under pressure from whom?
From their constituents?
Because none of their constituents knew who this guy was before.
I doubt a lot of the senators did. But unfortunately,
I want to find out what states they're from and what states, if those states have are home to like massive military contractors.
I mean, that's one of the frustrating things. The Wall Street Journal had this long piece. The thing I just referenced is like halfway in it. It's one sentence. And then that's it. It begs so many questions, and we have no answers at this point. And we're also gonna have some video of Mike Pompeo, which will probably answer none either. So, okay, let's jump into a little bit of his attempt last night to clarify the intelligence leading up to that strike. Obviously, many Democrats have been frustrated by the briefing that happened a couple of days ago, even some Republicans, including Rand Paul and Mike Lee. So here is Mike Pompeo.
There is no doubt that there were a series of imminent attacks that were being plotted by Qasem Soleimani. We don't know precisely when, and we don't know precisely where.
Okay, so
here's the thing. That's not what imminent means.
Imminent means something, and if we don't know when and we don't know where, look, that does not mean that they didn't have any intel. I don't believe that they had any intel, but they could hypothetically still have intel that was extremely vague.
But
this is not reassuring.
Well, he was planning attacks. That's kind of his job. And I don't want to excuse that by saying that's his job. But what I want to point out specifically is like the military has our military has a plan for everything. Our military always, you hear him talk about it. Like, I have a plan that if I want to do X, Y, and Z within the next like 3 or 4 minutes, I can do it. And is that what they're referencing? We don't know specifically because they're not telling us. And that smirk that I see on Pompeo's face looks like he's so pleased because he gets to be the guy who lies to us. Mm-hmm. He gets to be the guy who can show up and who can say, there's an imminent attack. Mm-hmm. I can't say any more than that. And he gets so horny from that. He gets so war hawk aroused mm-hmm. by being able to be the person who just, you know, disseminates vagaries and there is no consequence for it.
Yeah, and he has the smirk of a person who knows that nothing he says truly matters.
He's making it up. He's making it up. Prove me wrong.
Mm-hmm. We won't be able to, but we do have more video. And so take a look at this and see if you're as frustrated coming out of it as I was.
Well, the president said Soleimani wanted to blow up the embassy. Is that accurate? He wanted to blow up the embassy.
It was his forces that penetrated our embassy just a handful of days before that. Khatib Hezbollah warriors orchestrated, directed by Qasem Soleimani himself. I don't think there's any doubt that Soleimani had intentions not only to take action against our forces, our diplomats in Iraq, but in other countries around the region and world as well.
That wasn't a response to what she said was Trump, as of his last night rally, said they were going to blow up our embassy. That is a specific reference he is making to a specific plan. And when Mike Pompeo was asked about that, he says, well, you know, they surrounded the embassy. And so there's no doubt that they didn't like it. So was Trump making that up? Like, was the president like totally just of his own will making up a reference to a specific terrorist attack that was about to happen to justify what he did? Mike Pompeo had an opportunity to show that Trump had not just made it up, and he declined to do so.
Yeah.
And so coming out of this, I have to assume, Donald Trump just imagined, you know what will sound good? What if he was gonna blow up the embassy? That's good. Let's roll that out in public as if it's the truth.
Yeah, it's I was listening to CNN this morning, and it was Swalwell talking to, I think, Breonna Keeler. Mm-hmm. And there was just this voice that Breonna Keeler had where she knows she has to ask these questions. And Swalwell knows that he has to say, again, we are being essentially lied to by the intelligence, by like the intelligence briefers or who aren't giving us any information. And Breonna Keeler is just kind of going through the motions of like, here's what the president said. Are you refuting that? Are you directly refuting that? And I just want us all to take a breath and look at the media apparatus and say, it's the same thing. It's the same thing that always happens. They tell us that we really, you know, there are very important things that mandate that we need to take these military actions, and we can't tell you exactly what it is. And at the very best, we're cherry picking things that are tangentially related right before the part of the sentence that completely refutes it.
Yeah, and it has, like, getting to the bottom of whether they're lying or not, I think has become more consequential as time has come on for a couple of different reasons. First of all, the strike against Soleimani set off a chain of events through which we don't know all of the details, but a passenger jet was shot down and 162 people lost their lives, 176 people lost their lives. That's pretty consequential. Now there's reporting from the Wall Street Journal showing that it might have been intended to just shore up his support among Senate Republicans in advance of the Senate trial. All of this means that it's even more important than normal, and normally it's critically important to know if we're being lied to gin up support for a war. It's so important that we get to the bottom of this. And I would say that even in that case, he's being allowed to sort of just slip and slide his way through these interviews.
And the comparable previous escalation into war was in the wake of 9/11. So that was a wildly traumatic experience for the American public. So if I'm looking back, I can at least understand how people were a little blinded to the realities and not asking the questions that they should have been asking. But now there was no 9/11. Like, what are we doing? There wasn't anything. Why are they still falling victim to the same tricks without the excuse of having gone through a traumatic experience? Mm-hmm. And I think another thing that's important to focus on is if we're asking these questions like, are we safer now or not? Was it important to take out Soleimani or not? Just look at the before and after pictures. Before, there was a person in charge of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps and the Quds Force who was trying to back militias to work for Iranian interests against American interests. Look at after. They have someone doing that now.
Yeah.
They've been replaced.
Maybe that person's not as skilled.
But it's very. But maybe they're not as skilled. But they were in the. They were the number two. Mm-hmm. And it was. It's affiliated with a nation, with a country. It's not like there's when you kill Osama bin Laden, he's the guy in charge of a. He's like the best player on a crappy team, essentially. Mm-hmm. Instead of a country of millions and millions of people, the size of basically like a third to half of the United States, and they have a history of being like Persia, and then into Iran, and then they are like really good at war stuff. Mm-hmm. That's like a thing they do well. Mm-hmm. But then the before and after was before this happened. Yes, there were people, American interests abroad, who were in the standard amount of danger that they're always in as a result of years and years of American foreign policy.
Yeah.
But after this, they're in more direct danger, worse danger, and the after picture is worse than the before picture. Yeah. And you need to judge it as such.
And thankfully, the American people, according to surveys, seem to get that, even though it has not been made really clear to them by the media. At some point, you can't just have hard questions for Mike Pompeo. At some point, someone beyond just Chris Hayes has to have their show on MSNBC be, you know, we have given the administration I can't even tell you how many opportunities to prove that they did not lie us into this thing. They have declined to do so, and thus it is our responsibility to say they lied to us, and they continue to lie to us. And they can say that they want peace, but they just, the Iraqi parliament said they want our soldiers out. Military just put out a letter last night saying, nope, we're not going anywhere. In fact, we're sending more people in. They still want a conflict with Iran. I don't care about one little speech Donald Trump gave. He has multiple times brought us to the brink. He has done nothing to prove that he's not going to do that again. And with that combined with his rampant dishonesty means that no one should trust them when it comes to this topic. That is what all of them should be doing today. And unfortunately, I don't think it's going to happen.
Correct.
Even though as we transition to these other videos, we do have to go a little bit over because this is amazing. Mike Pompeo, he said, you know, it was an imminent threat that we had no idea when or where it was going to happen, but it was totally imminent. Thankfully, this morning, he is receiving some hard questions in relation to that. So let's jump now to this morning.
Mr. Secretary, the administration said this strike was done based on an imminent threat, but this morning you said we didn't know precisely when and we didn't know precisely where. That's not the definition of imminent. The president has also suggested that there was some sort of attack being planned against an embassy, perhaps several embassies. Can you clarify, did you have specific information about an imminent threat, and did it have anything to do with our embassies?
We had specific information on an imminent threat, and those threat stream included attacks on U.S. embassies, period, full stop.
So you were mistaken when you said you didn't know precisely when and you didn't know precisely
where? Nope, completely true. Those are completely consistent thoughts. I don't know exactly which minute. We don't know exactly which day it would have been executed, but it was very clear. Qasem Soleimani himself was plotting a broad, large-scale attack against American interests, and those attacks were imminent.
Against an embassy?
Against American facilities, including American embassies, military bases, American facilities throughout the region.
So everywhere, at all times, in all things, that's what he's saying. That's as specific as he's willing to be. He seems to indicate that Trump was lying last night when he said it was against an embassy. Except that, well, technically embassies are a thing that exists, and Soleimani was going to destroy everything. So I guess Trump was being honest.
And all that planning, that kind of activity would be kind of an overture to say, like, let's get in a war, America, mm-hmm. if it's as he characterized it. But their actions ever since then haven't been consistent with, let's get in a war, America, so that doesn't flesh out.
Yeah. Yeah, and exactly. Again, like your analogy about Osama bin Laden, if they had a plan to destroy all these things, it's not like Soleimani had the only copy of the plans in a thumb drive in his pocket. Theoretically, if he's taken out, all of the other people in the Iranian Revolutionary Guard that would have been involved in that would still have an interest in completing that mission. None of this is consistent, but it does beg a follow-up question with what he just said. What do you think the word imminent means?
What is your definition of imminent?
This was gonna happen.
That's good. That's reassuring.
Yeah,
it was gonna happen. Something. This,
yeah,
which is vague, was gonna happen at some point.
Yeah, that imminent. Yeah, imminent. Anything's about to happen. It was gonna happen. My 70th birthday is gonna happen.
Mm-hmm. At some point.
Is that imminent? Do I need to buy a cake today?
Yeah.
Stupid.
I would delay on the cake. Okay, we are gonna take a short break. We come back. Lots more to get to.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
I know that many of us have been raised to believe that America is number one in literally every way, but I happen to believe that there's a lot we can learn from other countries around the world. And right now we've got a segment where we're hopefully going to do quite a bit of that. We're joined now by Dr. Mandeep Rai, author of The Values Compass. Welcome to the show, doctor.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So you have this book where you are profiling values that are important to the cultures of 101 different countries. So I guess my first question is, how do you even go about doing that? That is just such a huge number of countries.
I actually have been to 150 countries, hope to have traveled the world within the next 5 years. So yes, it's a lot of countries. I just chose 101 because I thought that sounded like a cool number.
I agree. And so you have, give people an idea of what they can expect when they read the book. So how are you focusing on these different countries? Are you talking about general trends through history? Are you profiling individual people? What is their experience going to be like reading this book?
So essentially, you're taken around the globe. And I'm focusing on the one value, the one really, a value is something that you find important. And everyone finds different things important. However, given a country's geography, history, culture, context, people naturally want to evolve into their very best selves. So naturally, different countries have kind of culminated and evolved themselves with different values. So for example, education from Palestine. There are more PhDs coming out of Palestine than anywhere else in the world. Or silence from Finland, the way the Finnish really tried to preserve silence. Or solidarity from Madagascar. In Madagascar, because the insurance policy is not so strong, people are each other's security blankets and they're some of the nicest people in the world. Or hospitality from Turkey, or faith from India. If you ever have gone onto the roads in India, you're glad that there's every single god on the windscreen before you get into the rickshaw or the car. But actually it permeates through every part of their society, just like respect permeates Japan. So each of our cultures and in each of the contexts that we're born in, you find that you naturally will become a particular way. So for example, a deep Gerong Chai from Thailand, and you wonder why are they bringing 15 people into a meeting? Well, it's because they don't want to hurt one another, and there's this real sense of not stepping on the other person's heart, for example.
That's interesting. And so, look, going into it, I had been wondering, are there really 101 different positive values that a culture could focus on? But I hadn't thought about silence as one of those, and so I guess it is possible. But did you notice trends, either in different regions or across the world overall? Do there tend to be certain sorts of values that do pop up more often?
Maybe 101. Actually, I think there are even more values. A value is what you value or what you think is important. So there are many different things, from ambition, success, recognition, to love, compassion, patience. So the, you know, the list is actually endless. And are there trends? Most definitely. So for example, in Asia, right, I did see that thinking about the other came up much more than, for example, in Latin America, where passion and love and kind of this enlivenment comes up more, this wanting to move your body or wanting to self-express. Whereas in the Middle East, the sense of wanting to, with the UAE, I chose vision, or with Oman, honesty. So there are different continents that have different tendencies.
And so I'm curious, someone reading this, perhaps an American reading this, what can they learn? Are there any lessons that you discovered that pop out as something that we can look to and learn something that might help? I mean, we obviously as Americans, we have our own values. They're going to be very different than some other countries. Is there anything in particular that you would point out that you hope that an American reader might take away from reading your book?
Very, very good question. And so firstly, the book is meant to be a tool. So it's not really that as an American, you have to learn from other parts of the world. Of course, that's good. But actually, it's about you becoming really clear about what your core values are, what's important to you, and how to make them work for you so that you lead a more fulfilling, purposeful, happy life. That's the purpose, and it's the book is a tool, and I'll explain that. Are there certain values that I think Americans could benefit from, was your question? Mm-hmm. I think the reason Simon & Schuster, the American arm of Simon & Schuster, invested in this book is because they thought, yes. It's a little unfortunate that that I'm not able to get into America right now because of how it sees other cultures. So for example, if you have been to Iran, Syria, North Korea, there's a list of seven countries, then it's very difficult to get into the States, which is why I haven't been able to come in to promote my own book. So I would say that there are definitely values that we can learn from, and more than ever, it's important to be aware of what they are, because for example, Iran is working out of its value of commitment. Mm-hmm. The US is working from its value of pivot / entrepreneurship. And you can see countries actually working from their value space all the time. And if we just knew what they were, we would understand each other much better. And this book is really about understanding the other as well as understanding yourself.
And so finally, as you were traveling around the world, as you were cataloging these values, did you find that your views were changing as a result of the experience?
Very much so. I think the way this book came about was really that I was an observer everywhere, and moments would come in each and every place where you think, wow, if only we had, let's say, as much patience as I'm just referencing, I would say, each and every country, there was a moment when I thought, this really, if I used this in my life, where would I be tomorrow? Mm-hmm. And every single chapter, so every piece of the book, every different country, every different value has a takeaway, as in what would it mean, for example, if we knew that silence really was golden and what you can get from silence, or what would it mean if we, cleanliness from Rwanda, like when you just start your day in a clean way, when you just clean your desk and start in a fresh way, what difference does that make? So it's really practical tools.
Okay, well, it sounds awesome. I hope that people can take a look at this and learn something from your experience, your very broad experience there. Dr. Mandeep Rai, author of The Values Compass, thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
Thank you for having me, and I hope that each and every one of us will do the exercise and get down to our core values, so that your top five, once you have your top five in your back pocket and you've prioritized them, decision-making becomes much easier. Everything just becomes much more simple because you take decision-making out of your subconscious into your consciousness and you're able to thrive.
And thank you for that. We're gonna take a short break. When we come back, lots more to get through. Boeing has released a new batch of internal messages showing in the years leading up to the two crashes of their 737 MAX that killed nearly 350 people, how their own employees were worried about the rollout of new systems, the involvement of regulators in the process, and the overall design of the plane itself. So some of these are very rough to listen to with what we know now, but let's run through a few of them. The first, this airplane is designed by clowns who in turn are supervised by monkeys. That was one company pilot messaging a colleague back in 2016. That is not what you want your employees saying about a plane that tens of thousands of people will fly on every day.
Yes, this is, so the Boeing MAX was kind of the inevitable conclusion of a trend that has been, and there's this one amazing LA Times article that says that this started in like during the Cold War, this process. The process of the 737, it is an older plane in terms of like when it was first created. And they actually kind of in a roundabout way blame what's wrong with it now on trying to put stairs on the side of the plane before jetways so that you could open the plane and get out and get in easily. And essentially since then, they've kind of tried to maintain that ethos behind the plane in a jetway filled world by Frankensteining more things onto this plane that it does not, that at some point they really needed, if they wanted to keep going this way, they needed to scrap the plane and start a new one, a seven, pick a number, seven.
Mm-hmm. 777 maybe.
Well, they have one.
Yes, okay.
But the 797, yeah. Like or something like that, or completely rebrand it.
Well, yeah. And so look, with that knowledge, it sort of makes sense how terrible problems could develop.
Yeah.
The thing is, when you see all of these employees like almost in real time, but in hindsight, acknowledging these problems, but then sort of just like shrugging their shoulders and just saying, "Yeah, clowns, monkeys, what are you going to do?" But then hundreds of people die.
Well, there's things now on 730 on Boeing 737s that'll kill people. Mm-hmm. Like on the workhorse. The 737 is a workhorse. The idea that it, think of Southwest. Southwest is all 737s and now it has 800s and all the different ways down lower, but it is the thing that is most reliable. People love the hell out of it, but still like there are things that Airbus, their rival, has fixed that Boeing just keeps in there. Like if you are working at the gate, it is there isn't a fail-safe on the Boeing planes like there is on an Airbus plane that'll keep the slide from exploding in your face if the flight attendant on the inside fails to disarm it. When they say arm doors, disarm doors, they're arming the slide. And if they don't do it right, the Boeing plane, the Airbus plane is like, all right, we're stopped. Mm-hmm. Everything else is fine. I'm not gonna blow the slide. But it is possible. That little aspect of the Boeing plane.
That seems like that would be a software fix.
But it should be. There's things there's sensors and things. And, well, and so that's the one thing. With the MAX, what they ended up doing is they're like, we want bigger engines on it and we want more fuel efficient engines on it. And the only way to do that is now we need to slide the engines forward. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise the thing will like tip in one way or another. And so to get around that, they have this software system that they put in. Mm-hmm. And the software system says, if I get sensors, if I get in my sensors that the plane, because of the engines being where they are, that we're gonna tilt up and go into a stall, this MCA system, I think it's MCAS or whatever.
MCAS.
It tells the plane, all right, I'm going to dip the nose down.
Mm-hmm.
And if the sensor readings are wrong and you're the pilot on your Boeing, which has flown like this, like an idiot, instead of the Airbus, which is just a joystick that is much easier if you ask pilots, then it'll take your plane and just start nosediving it down.
Even when you're not actually going up into
a stall. Okay. And what's worse is they didn't tell the pilots this.
Yes,
the
and pilots so, and this, these communications really get into that. So let's go through a few of these really fast. In one exchange about the MAX flight simulators, an employee said, honesty is the only way in this job. Integrity when lives are on the line on the aircraft and training programs shouldn't be taken with a pinch of salt. Would you put your family on a MAX simulator trained aircraft? I wouldn't. So there they're talking about the safety if you had the pilots training on the simulators, but they were also behind the scenes fighting to stop that from actually having to happen.
Yes, and a lot of pilots never got this. Mm-hmm. One of the plane crashes that ended up happening, as reports went, the previous flight or one of the recent flights before that, there was a deadheading pilot, basically someone who's just kind of flying along in the cockpit, who when that started happening and it started tilting down was like, oh, you just have to pull back. You need to disable the sensors. It's just having a sensor glitch. The pilots on the next flight didn't know that and they crashed and died.
Exactly, yeah.
And they kept telling the pilots, it's just kind of a background software thing. You don't need to know about it.
Mm-hmm.
Because they knew that it was getting more and more Frankenstein-y. That's similar if you watch Fight Club, like if it costs more to do the recall than it does to do the lawsuits, we make a decision at that point. With the Airbus, they have this thing called the Neo, which is a better plane. And you ask pilots, it's a more comfortable cockpit. You walk in, it looks like it's from this century. And the Boeings all look like they're from last century. And they're just now, because of all that, and a lot of financial restrictions and a lot of incentives within the federal government to keep Boeing, our company, ahead of Airbus, a French company, it got to this point. And that's what we all are scared of. And that's one of the centers of progressivism is ground rules that keep that kind of stuff, that kind of corruption from happening. And it failed in this point.
Yeah. Yeah. And we're not going through the other comments, but a lot of them got into that the employees were bragging that they were able to browbeat potential like inspectors and regulators into not requiring the simulator time. They talked about the way that they were going to pitch that MCAS system as not a new system that would thus require new training, but just a modification to an existing one. So it's not a big deal. I mean, when you see that sort of thing, that by itself, if they had not gone in that direction, hypothetically might have changed everything when it comes to those two crashes.
Boeing's right now, if they, like Sully Sullenberger, it was an Airbus and it stayed like this on the water. It stayed horizontal, floating on the water. The Boeings tilt back. So if you land on the water in a Boeing aircraft, the back exits are unusable immediately. They have to some flight attendants have told me they have to prop up the back of Boeing planes when they come into the jetway because they're so back heavy. Because they've been Frankensteining
like
it the whole they have to do that. They have to put a jack up its butt to keep it from falling over because it's been Frankensteined so much instead of just starting over because Airbus, which is a newer company, created a better plane.
Yeah.
It's like if you're in an Airbus, then it's being run on like something that looks like an iPad. It looks more like it's from now. And if you go into the cockpit, the tiny cockpit of a Boeing plane with its literal like shag seats, you're like, what century is this plane in?
Yeah, yeah.
But the previous 737s worked fine. And this new one was just a step too far.
Yeah.
People knew it, and that's what's the biggest shame of it.
That's the biggest tragedy.
Because of it.
Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, lots more. So this is a dark thing to say, but I'm just gonna say, lately I have felt like, and correct me if you feel differently, when I hear that someone has died, like if I hear if you know a family member of a friend has died, my gut tells me that there's like a 75% chance that it was cancer related.
Yes.
That seems overwhelmingly what is causing deaths, unfortunately. And the weird thing is, the news that we just saw in the past week shows that apparently the situation with cancer is actually getting a little bit better. So the overall death rate from cancer in the US declined by 29% from the early 1990s to 2017. The largest ever single year drop in cancer deaths, 2.2%, spurred significantly by a dramatic decline in lung cancer deaths, occurred from 2016 to 2017. And so to some extent, I think that perhaps it's just I'm being, you know, deceived by anecdotal evidence. But it really does feel like despite the progress, and I know that there's a million people working on this issue every single day, that it is still overwhelmingly the thing that is causing deaths.
I think cardiovascular issues are the top, but
I think heart disease is still technically the most common.
Yes, but then again, yes, there's a lot of different ways your heart can kill you, especially if you're aging. There's a lot of other diseases that result in present as a cardiovascular failure or some kind of congenital heart failure or congestive heart failure. So that happens. With cancer specifically, there are these big, scary cancers that most people get. And this, I think, to me, just underscores the necessity to fund cancer research so that we can solve the big ones. Mm-hmm. Now, there are things that we've seen over the years that early detection helps and treatment helps. Our cancer rates going down are in line with other countries' cancer rates going down. We're slightly better than comparable countries when it comes to cancer mortality rates. We are not the best. We have, I think we're the fifth highest in terms of rates of getting cancer. Mm-hmm. I think this just underscores the need to fund cancer research more than anything.
Yeah, and then thankfully there's been a lot of great documentary research recently on perhaps why we get it at such high rates. In terms of what can be done about it, this is definitely one of those areas where the government can and has generally been helping to some degree at the very least. But theoretically could do much more. And it's a very common thing for candidates, even in this cycle, to say that we're going to take this out. Like Joe Biden has frequently said, like that is gonna be one of my priorities if I become president, is gonna be funding anti-cancer research.
So the government shot.
The moonshot, exactly. So the government can be out front involved in this. They can also take us in the wrong direction. And so we have a little mixture of both with our current government. So Donald Trump had tweeted out, US cancer death rate lowest in recorded history, all caps lock for some reason, or all capitalized. A lot of good news coming out of this administration.
This is so frustrating because he is the most anti-science president in generations.
Yeah.
This is a guy who denies climate change.
Or thinks that climate change just has to do with how clean the water is.
But more specifically, yeah, exactly. But in terms of how clean the water is, he talks about getting rid of all these regulations. So as I said, we're number five in terms of instances of cancer among the measured countries per capita. And we can cure it. But he's done so many things to keep giving it to us, to keep giving us cancer. His deregulation of environmental standards has wildly made us worse off.
Yeah.
And not just that, he has rolled back regulations that keep at bay factors that end up causing stillborns, stillborn babies. So he is upped it's literally called spontaneous abortion rates by taking out the regulations that kept women from being contaminated, largely through like coal runoff that would and particulate matter that end up killing babies in the womb. So he just loves this. This is the most Trump thing. If anything good happens, he claims credit for it. And it's so frustrating because at every turn he's working against those goals.
Yeah. And it doesn't mean that we aren't improving, but hypothetically his influence could be making it less of an improvement than it would otherwise be. And is it any wonder this is a guy who the only thing he wants to fight against that he thinks causes cancer are windmills, honestly. And so to be clear, Gary Reedy, CEO of the American Cancer Society, said the mortality trends reflected in our current report, including the largest drop in overall cancer mortality ever recorded from 16 to 17, reflect prevention, early detection, and treatment advances that occurred in prior years, that it was not Trump decisions that caused that. And in fact, we cannot forget that when a budget is made, it is an enumeration of our values and what we value and what we don't value. And Trump's 2020 budget plan slashed National Cancer Institute funding, nearly $900 million. That's a significant amount. A lot of research could be done with that money. That's not to say that they have not provided some funding for cancer research, but they have regularly in their budgets defunded that sort of research. And if you're gonna try to claim credit for being responsible for cancer rates dropping, how about you at least fund the research that's leading to those drops?
No, it's just a lot easier for him to claim credit after the fact.
It is simpler.
Yeah.
Okay. But we do have to go though. We got one more story for you. Stick around after this. Bombshell is still out in theaters right now, and we might in real life be having a little version of it, oddly enough. So there's this former Fox and Friends presenter and host, Courtney Friel. According to the New York Daily News, so she has claimed now, this is last week I noticed this story, claimed that Trump told her she was the hottest one at Fox News at one point, this is back during the campaign, when he called her after she expressed an interest in working on the Miss USA beauty pageant. So Friel claimed that Trump opened the call by asking her about her career, but as she recounts, then out of nowhere he said, "You should come up to my office sometime so we can kiss."
Ew.
It's so specific that it makes it sicker. But anyway, the journalist said that she was shocked by his invitation and wrote, "Donald, I believe we're both married, and I quickly ended the call." And she said, sort of tying it into the other accusations against Donald Trump that have come up constantly over the past few years, "It infuriates me that he would call all the women who shared stories of his bold advances liars. I totally believe them. At least now I can joke that I could have banged the president, but I passed." I wouldn't joke that. But so look, she had that experience. Unfortunate. It gave her a perspective on all of these other claims against Trump from all these other women. But here's the thing, that's not where the story ends. So that story comes out, and then there's a follow-up story. Was this ex-Fox News anchor benched for accusing Trump? Because the thing is, she used to be on Fox and Friends, but she does weekend anchoring on KTLA. And apparently, following that story coming out, she was not in any of the blocks that she normally does over the following weekend. And so it left many people wondering, I mean, she just came out with this story about Trump. We know what happens to women who make these claims that men have done these sorts of things. Was she being benched as a result of that? Now, it took about a week for KTLA to finally make clear that supposedly sometime later this month, she will resume. That although she said, "I was going to take a vacation later, they just sort of put me on the vacation early, and she's going to be doing press for her book." They're saying, no, she wasn't benched or fired or anything like that for the claims. She will be coming back.
KTLA, to give you a point of reference, it's not like a Fox affiliate. KTLA is an independent local news channel, and it's the fun one. It's like the one that we all grew up on, and they go, and they're the silly ones in the morning, and they have a good time.
I've done the show. I had a fun time.
Humble brag. So no, congrats. That's awesome. I'm wildly jealous, because I grew up watching them, and they seem like the fun ones. I wonder if this is less directed, and it's also Los Angeles, which is not exactly Trump country. I wonder if it's more related to their fears that she might write a book about them in the future, or just to not have her on when the going gets tough. But also, I'd say if I was producing that show, I'd want her on front and center.
Talking about the experience.
Because I think the optics on pulling her back is bad, to take her off magically when this drops, and B, people are going to tune in to see who the hell this person is.
Exactly, yeah. I don't know exactly what was going on. So you gave a couple of potential explanations. None of them are acceptable.
No.
To bench her in any way. And even, I mean, how could you not get how bad that would look? Of course, I mean, consider, like I said, Bombshell, still in the theaters. Like, we saw what happened to all of these women. Some of them still don't have careers in the media following their experience. Now, I don't know anything else about her time at Fox, whether KTLA has any sort of financial connection in any way to any Republican cause or anything like that. I sort of doubt it. But anyway, I would say that they need to be way more cognizant in the future of how these sorts of things will appear. And what we want is, we want women to feel 100% comfortable to come forward and talk about the things they've done. Especially, I mean, in this case, it corroborates the experience of literally dozens and dozens of other women, many of whom who have not been given a fair shake by the media, have been cast as liars or potential profiteers off of their experience. And here is a woman, Fox, like a Fox person, so this is not some crazy communist coming up with this, who says, yeah, that's basically the experience I had with Donald Trump back in the past.
Yeah, and it's disgusting, and unfortunately, She also said, I didn't come forward at the time when he was running for president. But like, how much worse could it have been for him, for America? We already proved that there are no consequences for his actions. There only seem to be consequences for calling them out.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, I guess with Bill Cosby, we discovered how many women have to come forward before it finally matters. But for Donald Trump, I honestly don't think that there's a number. I don't think if it had 100, Steve Doocy would take it seriously.
Yeah, and honestly, when you talk about who's the hottest one at Fox News, it is Steve Doocy.
Clearly.
Period. Speaking of hot things, you can watch Happy Half Hour tonight at 7 p.m. on the Young Turks Network and member as it streams to you for free, complete with extra web-only versions. So enjoy that.
That's awesome. Okay, well, thank you as always for joining me.
Yeah.
Everybody watching, I'm going to be doing the main show later on today. Cenk Uygur will be back in studio, so should be a lot of fun. I'm going to try to get through the whole show without coughing myself to death.
I heard you cried.
Stay tuned. But anyway, thank you for joining us throughout the week, and we'll see you on the Dan Report next Monday.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.